Good morning, Kasia.
Hi.
Hi there. So welcome to In Your Corner.
Thank you.
And I'm here with my co-host, John Spihar, and I would like to begin with a quote, a little blurb from Ali Smith of The Guardian. So you'll have to endure some praise here. Body is the kind of writer whose intelligence can bring together and reveal the patterns and resonances between such unlikely contenders as Plato, Scorsese, Fielding, Dickens, and Keith Haring. It's a beautifully illustrated, expert, readable, and startling expression of the dualities of all things. Body is the champion. I couldn't agree more. We're here talking with you about your new book, Boxing: A Cultural History. And my first question is, how did you become the boxing research champion, and what drew you to this topic?
I think, like a lot of kind of scholarship, it began really with something very small and specific, and then kind of gradually mushroomed. I think kind of looking back, and I've been working on it a long time, so my memories are hazy. I think it started by watching, I had a kind of period of watching some film noir from the 1940s, movies like Body and Soul or The Setup, and I became interested about women spectators, how they're presented in these films. You know, the good women would never go to the fights, and the bad women would be there, you know, with their blonde hair at ringside. And so that kind of intrigued me, and I started kind of watching more boxing movies, and then started reading Jack London's Boxing Stories and Nelson Algren's Never Come Morning, and, you know, and basically so on and so on and so on. And I think very quickly I became amazed at the extent of literary and artistic interest in the sport. I would never have guessed I would end up looking at people like T.S. Eliot or Mae West or people like that.
Kasia, absolutely brilliant book, first of all. I think I've read every boxing book that's ever been, and this is the book that I would absolutely have loved to have written. So I'm completely jealous and coveted of your book. And one of the things that Benny and I talk a lot on the show about is how reflective boxing is on culture. And it's an ongoing theme. We talk about the heritage of boxing, things that go on. One of the things that I'm a big fan of is I'm a big fan of the really initial recorded history of boxing as through the eyes of Pierce Egan in Boxiana. Yeah. And it's really hard for me not to draw a comparison between Regency England as it made its transition to Victorian England and the Roaring Twenties of the Americas as they switched over into the Prohibition. So you have some real bawdy times where boxing was kind of a common ground for both the gentry and for the working class, and then all of a sudden it stopped. And you find that stopgap seems to be during the Victorian era, as Victorian England began to emerge out of Regency England, and as the Roaring Twenties ended into the more sober and Great Depression and the Prohibition. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, no, I think it's a very sort of interesting comparison, and I suppose the only difference would be that that in the kind of Victorian era, boxing still were, I mean, although boxing kind of carried on the edges in Britain anyway, it was still illegal and a kind of fairly underground activity. Whereas by the 1930s, although things had changed from the 20s, I mean, boxing was now a kind of mass culture, you know, quite firmly established as a mass culture sport, and particularly when radio starts in the 30s. So it kind of didn't go away in the way that it did ever, in Victorian England. It almost kind of vanished a bit. So that would be my only difference. But I think Egan is such an influential figure in the history of boxing. And the great American sports writer A.J. Liebling kind of always imagined himself as Egan's successor and tried to use his kind of language.
Oh, there's no question. His prose was absolutely an ode to Egan. There's no question.
Yes. Well, it's a kind of, it's like a language in itself, you know. There's English and then there's Egan, you know, it's a different language. Yeah.
Well, you know, I for our listeners who are unaware of who Pierce Egan is, Pierce Egan was one of the first writers to give serious written thought, I guess, for lack of a better term, to boxing as a pastime. I mean, he, of course, did other things, but, you know, we owe the term the sweet science of bruising to Pierce Egan, and clarets, meaning a bloody nose, and things like that. It's a wonderful way of doing it. One of the things that I dug up after reading, you know, the first couple of chapters in your book, is I have in my hands a proposal for the erecting of an amphitheater for the manly exercise of boxing by none other than Mr. John Jack Broughton. And this is dated January 1st, 1940, or excuse me, 1743.
Yes.
Jack Broughton, so just a quick background for our listeners, and Kasia, you're well aware of this, was credited with two phenomenal innovations in the sport of boxing that has carried over into the present day, and the first of which was boxing gloves, and the second of which was a unified system of rules that kind of created a forum for boxing so that, you know, all classes could kind of enjoy them. And I think, well, let me get some thoughts on you on Jack Broughton, because you mentioned him extensively in your book. You talk about that period of England with great detail. So some thoughts and feedback on that would be wonderful, Kasia.
No, well, I suppose it's sort of interesting, you know, why boxing emerged in England when it did. You know, because although they look back to the kind of classical period in Greece and in Rome, really boxing hadn't, through the medieval period, boxing pretty much disappeared through the 14th, 15th centuries. And the first boxing match recorded in England seems to be, at least the first I could come across, is 1681. And it seemed to be with butchers and blacksmiths and watermen, so men with a lot of upper body strength in trades with upper body strength would fight. And I suppose what seems to be John Broughton's role in it is that the idea of gambling that aristocrats became increasingly interested in betting on fights, and Broughton had the patronage of the Duke of Cumberland through this period. And I think it's because of that patronage that all these things happened. So that when aristocrats were wagering really very large sums of money on these fights, they needed rules so that they could settle their wagers. So they needed rules about how a round would end, how seconds and umpires should behave, you know, even how they would know when the fight was over. And John Broughton's kind of downfall really came in 1750 when the Duke of Cumberland lost £10,000
against Jack Slack.
Yes, and closed the amphitheater. So so it was immediately. I mean, you couldn't really have a better example of how that patronage worked, because, you know, when it was withdrawn, suddenly all the magistrates who had been kind of turning a blind eye to boxing suddenly started pursuing boxers.
Well, I think what we see in that period is definitely the first stages of commercialism within boxing. I mean, certainly some of the more colorful names of that particular area is the, you know, Sam the Bath Butcher Martin, Gasman Tom Hickman, Tim and Bill Hooper. Again, these are tradesmen who had tremendous upper body strength. But I think one of the things that Broughton did is, I think he was very aware very early on that for this to become commercially viable, for this to become something of a financial success, he had to secure the patronage. And I believe you quote this in the book, but also in his proposal, one of the things that Broughton suggests is, of course, the use of boxing gloves.
Yeah.
So that, and let me, in fact, I'll get to the quote right here. Distinctions may not deter from entering in the course of these lectures. They will be given the utmost tenderness in regard to the delicacy and the frame and constitution of the pupil. For which reason, mufflers, which is the term for boxing gloves back in those times, are provided that will effectively secure them from the inconveniences of black eyes, broken jaws, and bloody noses. Again, I think Broughton wanted to make this more of a gentleman's sport, and, you know, there's been all kinds of speculation, and Kasia, I don't know if you found anything in your research for it, because I certainly found none in mine. The urban myth, as it were, is that Broughton killed a man, and because he killed a man, he took on this great stance and wanting to make boxing more safe and this than the other thing. And I don't see any evidence in that. I see evidence that Broughton realized that for this sport to become a financial success, one of the things that he needed more than anything was patronage, and you couldn't have the nobles walking around beat up.
No, exactly. I think that's much more plausible explanation of the mufflers. But I suppose that this is also the kind of first division between professional boxing and amateur sparring, really. That, you know, while, and that somehow these two sports would run in parallel, so that the aristocrats really would love to go and watch Broughton and other fighters later, Mendoza and so on, bare knuckle fighting. And they like to watch these fights that went on for, you know, 6 or 7 hours and ended up with people really very bloody-nosed and black-eyed. And they wanted to do something that was a kind of... I think Piers Egan uses the phrase that it's a kind of... I can't remember his actual phrase, but he's saying that this is a kind of imitation sport, sparring. So that the aristocrats in these academies would go and do it, but they wouldn't want to, first of all, spar, and they wouldn't want to fight to get injured, and they wouldn't want to do it under the same kind of circumstances, outdoors in the rain for 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So suddenly there became this great fashion, I suppose a bit later, really, in the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, for boxing schools. And one of the cartoons I have in the book from 1788 is that a school is advertising that they'll paint on a black eye because it then became fashionable to have your black eye. You know. I think it was a bit of a joke. But,
very, very Anthony Burgess, Clockwork Orange.
Yes, exactly.
I have a question, Kasia, about Mendoza.
Yes.
I had the fun of going to the Beinecke Book Library at Yale to read his actual memoir research for a memoir I'm attempting to write. And I got the impression from your book that you thought that Mendoza's memoirs were not necessarily written by him. Because
well,
you refer
I mean,
to
not,
yeah, go ahead. The first
this isn't
ghost written
that I've really done much kind of research myself into, but I think some other people have looked at it, and there is a suggestion that he may have had a ghostwriter. But I think it's very difficult to ascertain really. Mendoza and Richard Humphreys, his great opponent, also published a series of kind of challenges to each other in the press, and it's suspected that Piers Egan may have also been involved in writing some of those challenges. I can't really say more whether, you know, how to what extent Mendoza wrote it himself or whether he had some help, but, you know, people like to claim this is the first ghost-written sports autobiography, but...
Oh, that's very interesting. I hadn't heard that. You know, I just got the impression that Mendoza and Humphreys had this weird love relationship, sort of like Freud and Jung many years later.
Yes.
You know, publishing the letters and all the challenges and everything. You know, your book talks so much, as John was alluding to, about British history and also notions of masculinity and some of the dialectics of boxing. Was boxing in any way, are there any feminine attributes to boxing? Because when you talk about all of this aristocracy and the fancy and, you know, the clubs and the getting together and the clothing. Could you attribute any femininity in there?
In terms of the men or in women's boxing?
In men. In the sport as a whole. Because it is so much seen as a masculine endeavor. And, of course, you know, there are women boxers and, you know, we enjoy it. But it definitely has that reputation.
I mean, in the early 19th century, this is the sort of period of kind of dandies. And again, with the aristocracy in England, the kind of regency aristocracy, who were very interested in wearing, you know, very tight trousers, tight waistcoats. There was a lot of Beau Brummel, this kind of era of what kind of cravat you wore. And in some ways, you could say there's a kind of effeminacy in their concern with clothing and their bodies. And these were the same people who were going to the boxing academies and being very concerned about, you know, how they would look in their tight clothes.
Yes.
And Byron, the poet Byron, who was very keen on boxing, you know, was, by modern standards, we could say maybe he was a bit anorexic, or, you know, he wrote his diaries full of how many crackers he ate every day, as well as when he's boxed, and, you know, he lost a lot of weight by boxing. So I think there are ways in which, you know, this kind of certain class of men's preoccupation with their figures, and certainly in the early 19th century, does resonate to modern reader as kind of feminine, yes.
Well, I think also, especially when you consider the case of Lord Byron, there was, I don't know if it was thinly veiled in the time or if it was maybe perhaps a poorly kept secret, but there was always the attachment between him and champion at the time, John Jackson.
Yes.
And there was certainly more than one incident where they were romantically linked.
Yeah.
They were in their company quite a bit. But, you know, back to Binney's observation, you know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, as early as 1722, in fact, and Kasia, you certainly list in your book, the challenge between Elizabeth Wilkinson and Hannah Highfield, where they very publicly challenged each other. And, you know, I think one of the things that has gotten a resurgence here in the United States is women's boxing.
Sure.
And certainly boxing purists shake their head and say, oh, this is a travesty. How could we let this happen? When, if we go back to, again, as far as 1722, women boxing has been, it's been quite prevalent. It's been around. It's not, it hasn't gone anywhere.
No. I think people were more relaxed about it in the 18th century. And although it was in a kind of slightly soft porn way, often, you know, a lot of these cartoons and descriptions of these fights are about the women boxing, and suddenly their bodices fall off and their breasts are exposed. And that seemed, you know, so the reports of these fights often seem to be written for a male.
God,
leadership.
Just the word bodice is erotic, you know.
Yeah, it is.
Yes. but it wasn't seen as a kind of contradiction in terms, almost, that women boxed, that it became really in the Victorian era. And in the book, I have some cartoons from the sort of mid-19th century, which seem to imply, you know, the idea of women boxing becomes just as a phrase, a kind of joke, and everybody can laugh at it because it seems such the opposite of the domestic woman that was established by the kind of Victorian era.
We're talking with Kasia Boddy about her new phenomenal encyclopedic collection, Boxing, A Cultural History, distributed by Reaction Press, which I believe is affiliated with University of Chicago Press. And so in the 1880s, when New York became one of the centers of fighting and, in fact, became the first state to legalize a version of it, is this when things in America, you know, bringing it to America and all that, started to become more rough and tumble and certainly less aristocratic, given the fact that the immigrants were, using it as a way to get a leg up economically.
I mean, I guess a bit, even a bit earlier in the States, I mean, there seemed to be certainly in the South that plantation owners often sent their sons, you know, Virginian plantation owners would send their sons to England to be educated, and in the 18th century even, and they would kind of encounter boxing and bring it back to plantations, which is how kind of boxing began, you know, in the kind of southern slave context. And I think really through the growth of American urban centers throughout the 19th century that you get, you know, these kind of development of fighters, including the famous Heenan, Tom Heenan, who came to England and fought Sayers. And I suppose, but really by the 1880s and 1890s, I mean, the first real kind of, I suppose, you know, national champion in some ways is John L. Sullivan, and that really established, you know, with him, American boxing was really established at the forefront of world boxing.
You know, by the way, you mentioned the plantations, and that is one sorry chapter in the history of boxing,
yeah,
are the slave owners having the slaves box for them. And as you put it so well, one big difference in how perverse, let's say, that was that there was no audience. And so going back to your interest in, you know, the woman spectator and so forth and spectatoring, audience seems to be a fundamental part of boxing.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the combatants and the spectators?
Well, I guess a lot of, I suppose, the art and kind of writing about boxing that I've encountered is kind of nervous about what those artists and writers feel about the whole thing. And I guess part of their anxiety is about the audience and the effect of watching a fight on the audience. And this really goes back to St. Augustine being worried that watching fighting is actually, you know, you shouldn't outlaw boxing because it's bad for the boxers. You should outlaw it because it's bad for people to get that kind of pleasure of seeing other people fight together. And I think that's been a very influential kind of strain of thought through to these movies and through to people thinking about, you know, a lot of the 40s movies and even later are kind of focus always on the crowd, the setup. Has a scene where somebody is kind of eating hot dogs while watching the fight, and you see the kind of grease dribbling down his face, and there seems to be something kind of disgusting about fight fans in a lot of those films, and that what they're there for is not sport but blood, seems to be the message.
And the knockout. They're there
the
for
knockout,
the knockout.
Yeah. That, well, what they're interested in is kind of sanctioned violence rather than skill or technique. Or
so, Kasha, I think what we're looking at with boxing crowds, and it's funny, too, because, you know, you can certainly make the argument for either side, is that these people are here to certainly cheer on their heroes, to live vicariously through them. That's one side. And certainly the other side is these people are abject cowards who certainly could never do something like this on their own. So yeah, they live for the blood because their lives are empty in that regard as well. So I think that there's a lot of social commentary, not just in the
Absolutely.
Boxers themselves, but the folks who come to see boxing. And I am a lifelong boxing fan. I have boxed myself. I have been to hundreds and hundreds of fights. And I think it's really very interesting to understand the crowd makeup and how that works out. I mean, I think most recently, and Benny and I have talked to a great deal about this on our show, the Oscar De La Hoya and Floyd Mayweather fight.
Yeah.
That was, I mean, not only was the crowd anticipation, the home, the pay-per-view was one of the most successful ever, and the marketing, I think now boxing has also become big business, and in respect to advertisers. So clearly, whether the fans are sloths or there to see their favorite gladiator, marketers are paying attention to this. And you do discuss this a great deal about how this affects how the marketing of boxing has changed over the years as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the kind of continuing success, the continuing pull of Mike Tyson, really, is almost an example of this, that nobody now thinks of Tyson at all in terms of what's going to be a good fight, but he still seems to be always promising comebacks, and people are hoping he's going to bite somebody.
Bite somebody, exactly. What's next?
What's so great about your book is that in covering all these aspects of culture, film, literature, music, etc., the archetype of the boxer, you know, our projection onto the boxer is explored so thoroughly. And you describe something that I hadn't thought of before. You know, people talk about boxing as either a metaphor or not a metaphor. But you have a great section here. Allow me to just read on page 128. The boxing story provides an accelerated version of this phenomena, and the phenomenon sort of meaning that it's a metaphor for life. If the arc of a man's life in general is short and sharp, that of a boxer's is considerably shorter and sharper. This was a theme in boxing literature from its very beginnings in Homer and Virgil, where the aged, i.e. 35-year-old boxer, faced callow youth. Wrote Pierce Egan, no men are more subject to the caprice or changes of fortune than the pugilist. So this notion of the boxer as having a condensed version of the boundedness of life with its shortness, with its brutality, was very, very fascinating to me.
I suppose it's not only the individual fight that shows that, you know, that there is a kind of sense of the fight itself as enacting a kind of drama of life, but the boxer's career, as you say, being old by 35, seems to be one that, you know, a particular strand of writers and artists pick up, and that's what seems to be the metaphor for them.
And as you looked into literature, you looked at the authors like Hemingway and Mailer. Well, let's take Mailer. Yeah. He seems to be someone, and you've read him more exhaustively than I, who, let's see, was extremely envious, let's put it that way, of their ability, and I think wanted to best them in a way or befriend them. Then you have Philip Roth, you know, with his being able to recite all the names of the Jewish boxers from history as sort of heroes, but almost Gentile heroes in a way, because you were not told, you know, Jewish boys were told not to fight and not to be into sports. It was not considered right, and the Jews were more the bookish scholars. So it's a funny kind of identification that he's got.
Well, I think his favorite boxer has my favorite name, Slapsy Maxey.
Rosenblum.
This is great. And, I mean, I think Roth uses kind of Roth's interest in boxing. It kind of is remarkably long-lasting, and, you know, when you kind of start looking for it. And I think it is partly an interest in kind of conflict, in a kind of dialectic between different points of view, and between, you know, not only between Judaism and the kind of Gentile American identity that he explores in his fiction, but also between different versions of a Jewish identity. And, you know, you get in stories where the kind of Roth character, the Zuckerman character, is arguing with his father, and often in kind of boxing language. And the idea of the counterpunch. I mean, I suppose partly to come back to your question about metaphor, is that, you know, partly why the book is so long is that I was interested in the idea that there are many different kinds of metaphors and many different ways that writers and artists have used boxing, and that there isn't kind of one meaning for everybody. So for Roth, the idea of the counterpunch becomes almost the most potent image for him that he can use. You know, whatever society throws at you, you've got to come back with something. And he does that again and again with the fiction.
Whereas for
Mailer, it's something a bit different. Yeah.
I suppose that kind of goes back to the great Jewish boxer Benny Leonard.
Yes.
And some of those lightweight fighters who were very, very interested in exploring defense.
Yes.
You know? Definitely. So our job is not to get hurt.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
Absolutely.
There's also something
that a lot of the black heavyweights, you know, like Jack Johnson, were kind of defensive fighters. And Johnson's great biographer, Randy Roberts, sports historian, has kind of written about that, that, you know, the sense of not being able to be seen to be aggressive. That you could win your fight, but you had to win it with the minimum, and not be seen to be trying to hurt your opponent. So it's something that Jewish lightweights and black heavyweights seem to have in common.
Well, I think it's funny too, because we talk about metaphor and the changing of times and how boxing and boxers signified that change. Yeah. And one of the things that comes to mind is, and you talk about it, Akasha, in your book, is the great John L. Sullivan.
Yeah.
John L. Sullivan was, quite frankly, the epitome of the Irish immigrant in the United States in that time period. He was big talking, big drinking. He was exactly the stereotype that Irish fighters have enjoyed, I think, over the years. And I think John L.'s defeat to gentleman Jim Corbett signifies not only a change in boxing styles, but I think it also reflects a change in American culture at the time. You know, American culture at the time was starting to become a little bit more genteel, certainly. I think that the brash talking, brash ways of John L. Sullivan was giving way to gentleman Jim Corbett. And I think the Corbett style of fighting and the Corbett style of lifestyle, as it were, I think is reflective in that era as well. And I think that there's a lot of this in boxing. And this is, again, one of the things that we talk a lot about on our show. So when you came out with this book, we were so happy. We can't tell you how thrilled we were.
That's right. One of the things that sort of interested me about Corbett was how, you know, his career really coincided, or his kind of peak coincided with the very early days of cinema, and how he used that, and cinema used him, really to try and open up to a wider audience, you know, to get women to be interested in boxing. And so all these kind of footage of Corbett wearing the skimpiest of little pants, turning to show his, you know, backside to the camera all the time in these films is kind of fascinating, and how, you know, women really flocked to see these movies, supposedly.
About halfway through the book, you've got a section on pugilistic aesthetics. And what is really delightful about this book, one of the many things, is that you go through and you think you know some of the films, you think you've seen some of the illustrations, and then your collection just blows the mind. I didn't realize, for example, that boxing was, the language of boxing was so useful for 20th century artists. And that the Dadaists, for example, which is an art movement I've always had a little love for, utilized that or had a fascination with it.
Yes. I mean, I suppose it's just, you know, how really resonant boxing is in so many ways, and that, you know, again, in different periods and for different people, they would pick out different things and, you know, different aspects of it. And particularly the changes in the sports, you know, post-Queensberry rules and so on, meant that knockouts were much more of a feature of, and became a feature of, the modern sport. And that was really what the Dadaists liked, and modernism generally.
They liked the knockout?
The knockout as a kind of decisive answer to things you didn't like. You know, that whatever was wrong, the knockout would be something swift, something kind of uncontroversial. I mean, come back at a ball. I don't know how to say it.
Sort of revolutionary?
Yes, like, and revolutionary.
In that political spirit?
And Dada was also interested always in kind of opposition, you know, in putting one thing against another, and I think boxing.
Well, I think the knockout also symbolizes a vindication as well. Yeah. And if we look at, you know, certainly one of the heavyweight fights that had the most political ramification in our era would be the Joe Louis-Max Schmeling fight.
Yeah.
And,
which is the anniversary not so long ago.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And one of the nice things, and we had David Margolick on the show, and we talked a great deal about this. I think that we transcended the mere sport, certainly, with that, because Max Schmeling, though not a Nazi, was reasonably familiar with those folks, which I imagine a lot of folks in Germany had to be at that time. And he came over as the supervillain. He came and he beat the American hero, Joe Louis. And what we found is in the rematch, when Joe Louis absolutely destroyed Max Schmeling, you know, it was a victory for an entire country. It was a victory for the Allies versus the Axis. So I think that we see, you know, again, the boundaries of boxing transcending into much, much bigger pictures.
Yes. I mean, of course, in that fight, it was also, you know, there was a kind of difficulty because Louis was both the American hero and the black hero, and
correct.
And in some ways, you know, in 1938, those two things were not so easily reconciled, and you know, I think some people, particularly when he became involved with the Navy Relief Fund and so on, were unsure really whether he was being used in a way, and you know. And I guess what happened to Louis suggests that perhaps the limitations of being thought of as an American hero.
Right. Oh, there's no question about it. And I think I think also, too, I think that it's very, you can certainly make the point that Schmeling was also used very succinctly by the Nazis as well.
Yeah.
I think they both were pawns in a much, much bigger picture. And I think certainly that's reflective of Louis's treatment after the wars and how Louis ended up. Schmeling, though, did very, very well. Schmeling was a vice president of Coca-Cola forever and ever, and he did quite well. So
let me interject now just with a station ID, if I might. The radio station is WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and WPKM 88.7 FM, Montauk, New York. We're also on the web at WPKN.org, and we're talking with Kasia Bhatia about boxing, a cultural history. And Kasia, we have more questions, but I don't want to keep you. I feel like we're tiring you out or something, perhaps. Because one of the things I so appreciate as a DJ is your discussion about music and boxing. And I want to just play you a little bit, and we'll talk about what I am playing here.
I am just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I have squandered my resistance for a pocket.
Now, that is a song that was written by Simon and Garfunkel, I believe, or Paul Simon, the boxer. This is a version by Waylon Jennings. What you mention in your book is that in the third verse, which has the most detail about boxing imagery, is that they're actually singing about Bob Dylan, possibly.
Well,
can you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, I think this is kind of speculative, really.
but a juicy tidbit, nonetheless.
Simon and Garfunkel kind of making fun of Dylan's self kind of image, really. I don't know. But I suppose it's the idea of the song is that, you know, the come-ons from the whores on 7th Avenue. Is that a reference to the bosses on Columbia Records?
Right.
Yeah.
Dylan was coming out of poverty and then getting kind of swept up. But
yes,
it's just,
I think Simon Garfunkel tended to make fun of Dylan's tendency to sort of imagine himself as a fighter or as a poor boy, or as, you know, in various ways that were kind of persona that weren't quite accurate.
And then Dylan himself in the Hurricane song, that Hurricane Carter has some boxing imagery as well.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Dylan has several several songs about boxers. Who Killed Davy Moore was his first one in 64, you know, about the death of Davy Moore, which was seen on television and became a kind of great kind of scandal. And then in 76 he took up the cause of Reuben Hurricane Carter and played benefits for him with
which, incidentally, was an incredibly successful campaign that led, in fact, to the release of Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Yes, absolutely.
And he talks about this. He goes to college campuses now, and he speaks about this quite frequently.
Yeah. And Nelson Algren, kind of neglected writer, I think, these days, also wrote a book about Hurricane Carter, The Devil's Stocking. Yeah, it was a kind of counterculture campaign, really, in the mid 70s, and all sorts of people were involved. Burt Reynolds and people like that all kind of rallied around. Yeah.
Speaking of the 70s, oh my God, Superman versus Muhammad Ali. why wasn't I a kid then?
I have that. I absolutely have that. Are you kidding me? Oh, absolutely.
Do you have it from the...
You can get it on eBay.
Oh, you can?
That's where I got it.
But now listen, Kasia, now, you know, we should have a contest, Benny Klein, to see who our listeners think won.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Right?
Okay, so I'm going to give them the phone number. They can call us afterwards.
They can call us. Let me know who won.
203-331-9756. Who won? Was it one issue or a series?
No, it was one issue.
One issue.
There's one issue.
Wow. Is that like a collector's item?
I am absolutely sure it is.
Just flipping through the illustrations
in
here are so amazing.
It's gorgeous. But, you know, I found it on eBay, so, you know, tell your listeners.
That they can, too.
Yeah.
Kasia, you know, you're a professor of English literature.
Yes.
So, are you on a reading tour with this great book? What are your plans?
No plans, really. I'm actually coming to the States on holiday, but I'm just
on holiday.
I'm just here on.
And we can't lure you to do a reading somewhere, eh? Or set something up. Of course, it's not much advanced time, but
well, maybe ask
your publicist.
Yeah.
Well, Kasia, let me ask you this, and this is the. This is the question that I looked at this book, and it absolutely fascinated me on so many different levels. Who did you write this book for? Tell me about your audience. When you sat down to do this, what was your goal?
I don't know if I'm as organized as you suggest. I think I started with the idea, you know, as I said, I was kind of looking at some films and sort of writing in the 30s. And I think I started with the idea that it was going to be about boxing in late 20th century culture. And then I kind of got pulled backwards. And that's my background is the 20th century. But I sort of realized that didn't make sense without looking at the 19th century, and that didn't make sense without looking at the classical side. So the whole thing took much longer, obviously, but I then felt that it should be kind of chronological. And I don't know, I suppose my audience was myself, and that this is the kind of book I would like to read. And I don't know if I really thought more than that.
Are you pleased with the response? You've gotten some wonderful reviews, including a great one from Joyce Carol Oates in the New York Review of Books.
Here is what I am in the process of doing. I will give you my master plan, and I will tell you now in my plan, my quest for boxing world domination, where you, Kasia Bhatti, fit in. one of the things I've been developing over the course of the year is a comprehensive curriculum for a college-level course on boxing as culture.
Right.
And when I read this book, first thing I said to Benny, I said, when I get this class off the ground, when I get this course done, this is going to be the textbook.
Oh.
So I'd like your permission to use that.
Absolutely.
You know, certainly, because I think really what we have here is we have just an outstanding combination of sport, metaphor, life. I mean, you know, when Benny talked about a boxer's life being short and brutal and the cycle of life being short and brutal, I mean, certainly we can go all the way back as far as Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, who talked about man's existence being nothing but short and brutal. And I think that there's so many interconnectivity here that we can make outstanding arguments for. Not, you know, notwithstanding, I mean, in the United States, we're in an election year. And there is not one candidate that in one speech or another has not mentioned some type of boxing metaphor. I'm not down for the count, according to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep punching. You know, the fight's not over. Going into the last round, I'll be saved by the bell. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And I think that this is one of those things that is certainly often misunderstood by scholars. And I think that it's overlooked. And I think that there's a lot of significant ties. And I think there's so many examples of it in our everyday life that I think it certainly warrants further study on a more significant academic level, which you've done a magnificent job doing. I just can't give you enough praise for this book.
Well, it's very, very kind of you.
Oh, I'm just a guy in Bridgeport. Just relax, but thank you.
Just a guy in Bridgeport. Come on. One of the most articulate boxers I've ever known. Do you ever watch boxing, Kasia? Do you enjoy watching it or going to fights?
Yes. I mean, when years ago, I had a boyfriend who boxed. Amateur boxing, and I used to go and watch him quite a bit. And I've seen, you know, but I haven't actually been to live professional boxing. So I've been to quite a lot of amateur stuff, but my only experience of professional fights are on TV and movies, kind of old footage of stuff.
You know,
I actually spend much more time watching soccer than boxing, I have to say.
That's a cool sport.
My husband is a big Arsenal fan. If your
Arsenal?
Listeners know Arsenal.
Is that a soccer person?
It's a team.
Arsenal is a soccer team.
All right. John is rolling his eyes at me.
Sorry.
Unbelievable. Well, I tell you, when you come out for holiday, keep us in the loop. Benny and I are, I guess, certainly boxing groupies, maybe an extreme word for it, but we certainly do attend most of the pro shows in the Northeast. We attend all the amateur shows. I mean, we do quite a bit of that, and we would love to have you as our guest. So keep that in mind.
Anytime.
I don't know what your schedule will permit when you are, in fact, out here, but if you can do that, consider it an open invitation.
Thank you.
Also, Kasia, have you, given boxing's sort of ugly reputation amongst a lot of people who don't go into the nuances and the metaphors, did you meet any resistance in academic circles to your project?
I think there was a certain kind of rolling of my eyes from some people. The kind of most official resistance, in a way, was that I taught a course on boxing. My college has an exchange program with Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and in '96. So a long time ago, I taught a course on boxing fiction and film in a summer school at Dartmouth. And the New York Times kind of picked out this course as an example. They had an article about the fact students were not studying Shakespeare and were doing pop culture instead. And they listed some other courses about gangster literature. There. Yeah.
Oh, see, I'd love to see that syllabus.
Would this be the same New York Times that doesn't verify or check their facts? That's probably the same group, right? Yeah.
But I think, they had the National Alumni Forum, you know, what they were quoting as kind of objecting to it. But I think it was also that part of what I wanted to do in the book was kind of challenge that rigid distinction between, you know, so-called high culture and the rest of it.
Was it at all difficult getting a publisher?
No, I had written an essay some years ago about American travel writing, actually, American ideas of Europe in post-war period, that appeared in a book published by Reaction. And the publisher there liked the article and met with me and said, what are you working on now? And this was in very early stages of this book. But I sort of did an outline and told him. So he liked the idea, and that was it. It did turn out longer than they had hoped for. And so there was some kind of negotiations about the length and so on. But I was very lucky that they didn't make me kind of cut it in half.
Yes, and also
double the size I meant to write.
You have a phenomenal amount of color plates and illustrations.
Yes.
And that's often an obstacle for a publisher who will claim that it's too expensive to do that.
No, Reaction are kind of famous for doing really beautiful books.
And it is gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
That nice paper.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And as
well priced, I think. Even.
Yeah. Yes, it is actually. Now that I look down, it's 35.
Yeah.
So people should order it right away. And as Bert Randolph Sugar, who we spoke to some months ago, he had just come out with View from the Corner, mm-hmm. where he helped Angelo Dundee talk about his life as a trainer. When he said, we were talking about how we've always been told, and boxing books don't sell. And he said, they do if they have something to say. And Kashyapati, your book, Boxing, A Cultural History, has much to say. And it has been just a delight to have you. And I hope we will meet sometime and arrange some readings for you out here.
That would be great.
Okay. Well, thanks again.
Yes.